Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Pines by Blake Crouch, performed by Paul Michael Garcia.
Despite evidence that human evolution still functions, biologists concede that it's anyone's guess where it will take us from here. Time Magazine, February 23, 2009. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they aren't after you. Joseph Heller. Chapter 1. He came to lying on his back with sunlight pouring down into his face and the murmur of running water close by. There was a brilliant ache in his optic nerve and a steady, painless throbbing at the base of his skull, the distant thunder of an approaching migraine. He rolled onto his side and pushed up into a sitting position, tucking his head between his knees. Sensed the instability of the world long before he opened his eyes, like its axis had been cut loose to teeter. His first deep breath felt like someone driving a steel wedge between the ribs high on his left side, but he groaned through the pain and forced his eyes to open. His left eye must have been badly swollen, because it seemed like he was staring through a slit. The greenest grass he'd ever seen, a forest of long, soft blades, ran down to the bank. The water was clear and swift as it flowed between the boulders that jutted out of the channel. Across the river, a cliff swept up for 1,000 feet. Pines grew in clusters along the ledges, and the air was filled with the smell of them and the sweetness of the moving water. He was dressed in black pants and a black jacket, with an Oxford shirt underneath, the white cotton speckled with blood. A black tie hung by the flimsiest knot from his collar. On his first attempt to get up, his knees buckled and he sat down hard enough to send a vibration of searing pain through his ribcage. His second try succeeded, and he found himself wobbly but standing, the ground a pitching deck beneath his feet. He turned slowly, his feet shuffling and spread wide for balance. With the river behind him, he stood at the edge of an open field. On the far side, the metal surfaces of swing sets and sliding boards glimmered under an intense midday sun. Not another soul around. Beyond the park, he glimpsed Victorian houses, and farther on, the buildings of a main street. The town was at most a mile across, and it sat in the middle of an amphitheater of stone, enclosed by cliff walls rising several thousand feet on every side, and composed of red-banded rock. In the highest, shadowed mountain nooks, pockets of snow lingered, but down here in the valley it was warm, the sky above a deep and cloudless cobalt. The man checked the pockets of his slacks, and then of his single-breasted coat. No wallet, no money clip, no ID, no keys, no phone. Just a small Swiss Army knife in one of the inner pockets. By the time he'd reached the other side of the park, he was more alert and more confused, and the pulsing in his cervical spine wasn't painless any longer. He knew 6 things. The name of the current president. What his mother's face looked like, though he couldn't recall her name or even the sound of her voice. That he could play the piano. And fly a helicopter. That he was 37 years old, and that he needed to get to a hospital. Outside those facts, the world and his place in it wasn't so much hidden as printed in a foreign nomenclature beyond his comprehension. He could sense the truth hovering on the outskirts of consciousness, but it lay just out of reach. He walked up a quiet residential street, studying every car he passed. Did one of them belong to him? The houses that faced each other were pristine, freshly painted with perfect little squares of bright grass framed by picket fences, and each household name stenciled in white block letters on the side of a black mailbox. In almost every backyard he saw a vibrant garden, bursting not only with flowers, but vegetables and fruit. All the colors so pure and vivid. Midway through the second block, he winced. The exertion of walking had drawn a deep breath out of him, the pain in his left side stopping him in his tracks. Removing his jacket, he pulled his Oxford out of his waistline, unbuttoned the shirt, and opened it. looked even worse than it felt. All down his left side stretched a dark purple bruise, bull's-eyed with a swath of jaundiced yellow. Something had hit him. Hard. He ran his hand lightly over the surface of his skull. The headache was there, becoming more pronounced by the minute, but he didn't feel any signs of severe trauma beyond tenderness on the left side. He buttoned his shirt back, tucked it into his pants, and continued up the street. The blaring conclusion was that he'd been involved in some sort of accident. Maybe a car, maybe a fall, maybe he'd been attacked. That could explain why he carried no wallet. He should go to the police first thing. Unless... what if he'd done something wrong? Committed a crime? Was that possible? Maybe he should wait, see if anything came back to him. Though nothing about this town struck him as remotely familiar, he realized, as he stumbled up the street, that he was reading the name on every mailbox. A subconscious thing? Because down in the recesses of memory he knew that one of these mailboxes would have his name printed across the side, and that seeing it would bring everything back? The buildings of downtown lifted above the pine several blocks ahead, and he could hear, for the first time, the noise of cars in motion, distant voices, the hum of ventilation systems. He froze in the middle of the street, involuntarily cocking his head. He was staring at a mailbox that belonged to a red and green two-story Victorian, staring at the name on the side of it. His pulse beginning to accelerate, although he didn't understand why. Mackenzie. Mackenzie. The name meant nothing to him. Mac. But the first syllable did, or rather, it prompted some emotional response. Mac. Mac. Was he Mac? Was that his first name? My name's Mac. Hi, I'm Mac. Nice to meet you. No. The way the word rolled off his tongue, it wasn't natural. Didn't feel like anything that belonged to him. If he was honest, he hated the word because it conjured up fear. How strange. For some reason, the word instilled fear. Had someone named Mac hurt him? He walked on. Three more blocks brought him to the corner of Main and Sixth Street, where he sat down on a shaded bench and took a slow, careful breath. He looked up and down the street, eyes desperate for anything familiar. Not a chain store in sight. There was a pharmacy catty-corner from where he sat, a cafe next door, a three-story building next to the cafe with a sign overhanging the stoop, Wayward Pines Hotel. The smell of coffee beans pulled him off the bench. He looked up, saw a place called The Steaming Bean halfway up the block that had to be the source. Wasn't necessarily the most useful piece of knowledge, all things considered, but it dawned on him that he loved good coffee, craved it. Another tiny piece of the puzzle that constituted his identity. He walked to the coffee shop and pulled open the screen door. The shop was small and quaint, and just by the smell of things, he could tell they brewed great product. A bar down the right side faced espresso machines, grinders, blenders, bottles of flavor shots. Three stools were occupied. A few sofas and chairs lined the opposite wall. A bookshelf of faded paperbacks. Two old-timers were at war on a chessboard with mismatched pieces. The walls displayed local artwork, a series of black and white self-portraits of some middle-aged woman whose expression never changed from photo to photo. Only the focus of the camera changed. He approached the cash register. When the 20-something barista with blonde dreadlocks finally noticed him, he thought he detected a flicker of horror in her pretty eyes. Does she know me? In a mirror behind the register, he caught his reflection and immediately understood what had prompted her look of disgust. The left side of his face was blanketed in a massive bruise, and his left eye bulged, nearly swollen shut. My God, someone beat the shit out of me. Aside from his hideous bruise, he wasn't bad-looking. Figured he stood 6 feet tall, maybe 6'1", short black hair and a two-day beard coming in like a shadow across the lower half of his face. A solid muscular build evident in the way his jacket hung on his shoulders and the taut stretch of the Oxford across his chest. He thought he looked like some advertising or marketing exec, probably cut a damn striking profile when he was shaved and polished up. "What can I get for you?" the barista asked. He might have killed for a cup of coffee, but he didn't have a dime to whatever his name was. "You brew good coffee here?" The woman seemed confused by the question.
Yeah?
"The best in town?"
"This is the only coffee shop in town, but yeah, our coffee kicks ass."
The man leaned over the counter.
"Do you know me?" he whispered.
"Excuse me?
Do you recognize me? Do I ever come in here?"
"You don't know if you've been in here before?"
He shook his head. She studied him for a moment, as if appraising his candor, trying to determine if this guy with a battered face was crazy or messing with her. She finally said,
"I don't think I've seen you before."
"You're sure about that?"
"Well, it's not like this is New York City."
"Fair enough. Have you worked here long?"
"Little over a year."
"And I'm not a regular or anything?"
"You're definitely not a regular."
"Can I ask you something else?"
"Sure."
"Where is this?"
"You don't know where you are?"
He hesitated, a part of him not wanting to admit such complete and total helplessness. When he finally shook his head, the barista furrowed her brow like she couldn't believe the question.
"I'm not messing with you," he said.
"This is Wayward Pines, Idaho. Your face. What happened to you?"
I don't really know yet. Is there a hospital in town?"
As he asked the question, he felt an ominous current slide through him. A low-voltage premonition? Or the fingers of some deep-buried memory drawing a cold finger down his spine?
"Yeah, 7 blocks south of here. You should go to the emergency room right now. I could call an ambulance for you."
"That's not necessary." He backed away from the counter. "Thanks." "What's your name?"
"Miranda."
"Thanks, Miranda."
The reemergence into sunlight made his balance falter and cranked his budding headache a few degrees into the lower range of excruciating. There was no traffic, so he jaywalked to the other side of Main and headed up the block toward 5th Street, passing a young mother and her little boy who whispered something that sounded like,
"Mommy, is that him?"
The woman hushed her son and caught the man's eye with an apologetic frown, said,
"I'm sorry about that. He didn't mean to be rude."
He arrived at the corner of 5th and Main in front of a 2-story brownstone, with First National Bank of Wayward Pines stenciled across the glass double doors. Around the side of the building, he spotted a phone booth standing near the alleyway. He limped toward it as fast as he could and closed himself inside the booth. The phone book was the slimmest he'd ever seen, and he stood there thumbing through it, hoping for some revelatory breakthrough, but it was just 8 pages of several hundred names that, like everything else in this town, held no meaning for him. He dropped the phone book, let it dangle from its metal cord, his forehead resting against the cool glass. The keypad caught his eye. He smiled at the sweet realization, "I know my home phone number." Before lifting the receiver, he punched in the number several times just to be sure, and it seemed to flow off his fingertips with the ease of rote knowledge and muscle memory. He'd call collect, hope to God someone was home, assuming he had a someone. Of course, he wouldn't have a name to give them, not a real one at least, but maybe they'd recognize his voice and accept the call. He picked up the receiver and held it to his ear, reached for the 0. No dial tone. He tapped the hook several times, but nothing happened. It surprised him how fast the rage came. He slammed the phone down, an upwelling of fear and anger expanding like a rushed ignition sequence in search of some out. Cocked his right arm back fully, intending to put his fist through the glass, knuckles be damned, but the pain in his busted ribs blazed through everything and doubled him over onto the floor of the phone booth. Now the throbbing at the base of his skull was surging. His vision went double, then blurry, then to black. The booth was in shade when he opened his eyes again. He grabbed onto the metal cord attached to the phone book and hoisted himself onto his feet. Through the dirty glass, he saw the upper curve of the sun sliding behind that ridge of cliffs that boxed in the western edge of town. The moment it vanished, the temperature dropped 10 degrees. He still remembered his phone number, practiced it a few times on the keypad just to be safe, and checked the receiver once more for a dial tone. Silence, save for the faintest crackling of white noise bleeding through the line that he hadn't recalled hearing before. Hello? Hello? He hung up and lifted the phone book again. The first time, he'd searched the last names, groping for any word that jogged loose a memory or incited an emotion. Now he scanned first names, tracing his finger down the list and trying to ignore that pain at the base of his skull that was already creeping back. The first page, nothing. Second page, nothing. Third, nothing. Toward the bottom of the sixth page, his finger stopped. Scozy, Mac and Jane. 403 East 3rd Street, Wayward Pines, 83278. 5590196. He skimmed the last two pages. Scozy was the only Mac listed in the Wayward Pines phone directory. Digging his shoulder into the folding glass door, he stepped out of the booth into the early evening. With the sun now below the ring of cliffs, the light was spilling fast out of the sky and the temperature had begun to fall. Where will I sleep tonight? He staggered down the sidewalk, part of him screaming that he should go straight to the hospital. He was sick. Dehydrated, hungry, confused, penniless, his entire body sore, and it was getting more difficult to breathe with this debilitating pain racking his ribs every time his lungs inflated against them. But something in him still resisted the idea of going to the hospital, and as he moved away from the downtown toward the residence of Max Scozy, he realized what it was. Again, fear. He didn't know why. It made no sense, but he didn't want to set foot inside that hospital. Not in his present condition. Not ever. It was the strangest sort of fear, unspecified, like walking in the woods at night, not knowing exactly what you should be afraid of, and the fear all the more potent precisely because of its mystery. Two blocks north took him to 3rd Street, his chest inexplicably tightening as he turned onto the sidewalk and headed east, away from the downtown. The first mailbox he passed had 201 printed on the side. He figured the Scozy residence should only be two blocks away. Kids were playing in the grass of a yard just ahead, taking turns running through a sprinkler. He tried to walk upright and steady as he reached their picket fence, but he couldn't stop himself from favoring his right side to ease the jarring of his ribs. The children became still and quiet as he drew near, watching him shuffle past with unrestrained stares, a mix of curiosity and distrust that made him uneasy. He crossed another road, moving slower still up the next block as he passed under the branches of three enormous pines that overhung the street. The numbers of the colorful Victorians that populated this block all started with a 3. Scozy's block would be next. His palms were beginning to sweat, and the pulsing in the back of his head sounded like the thump-thump-thump of a bass drum buried deep underground. 2 seconds of double vision. He squeezed his eyes shut tight, and when he opened them again, it had gone away. At the next intersection, he stopped. His mouth had been dry, but now it turned to cotton. He was struggling to breathe, bile threatening to surge up his throat.
This will all make sense when you see his face. It has to.
He made a tentative step out into the street. Evening now, the chill coming off those mountains and settling down into the valley. Alpenglow had given the rocks surrounding Wayward Pines a pinkish tint, the same shade as the darkening sky. He tried to find it beautiful and moving, but the agony prevented this. An older couple moved away from him, hand in hand, on a quiet stroll. Otherwise, the street stood empty and silent, and the noise of the downtown had completely faded away. He moved across the smooth black asphalt and stepped onto the sidewalk. The mailbox to 401 was straight ahead, number 403 next in line. He was having to maintain a constant squint now to stave off the double vision and the stabbing throb of his migraine. 15 painful steps, and he stood beside the black mailbox of 403. Scozy. He stabilized his balance, holding fast to the sharp ends of the picket fence. Reaching over, he unlatched the gate and pushed it with the tip of his scuffed black shoe. The hinges creaked as it swung open. The gate banged softly into the fence. The sidewalk was a patchwork of ancient brick, and it led to a covered front porch with a couple of rocking chairs separated by a small wrought iron table. The house itself was purple with green trim, and through the thin curtains he could see lights on inside. "Just go. You have to know." He stumbled toward the house. Double vision shot through in nauseating flashes that he was fighting harder and harder to stop. He stepped up onto the porch and reached out just in time to stop from falling, bracing himself against the doorframe. His hands shook uncontrollably as he grabbed the knocker and lifted it off its brass plate. He refused himself even a split second to reconsider, pounded the knocker 4 times into the plate. It felt like someone was punching him in the back of the head every 4 seconds, and burning patches of darkness had begun to swarm his vision like miniature black holes. On the other side of the door, he could hear a hardwood floor groaning under the weight of approaching footsteps. His knees seemed to liquefy. He hugged one of the posts that supported the porch's roof for balance. The wood door swung open, and a man who could have been his father's age stared at him through the screen door. He was tall and thin, with a splash of gray hair on top, a white goatee, and microscopic red veins in his cheeks that suggested a lifetime of heavy drinking.
"Can I help you?"
the man asked. Ethan straightened himself up, blinking hard through the migraine. It took everything in his power to stand without support.
"Are you Mac?"
He could hear the fear in his voice, figured this man could too, hated himself for it. The older man leaned in toward the screen to get a better look at the stranger on his porch.
"What can I do for you?"
"Are you Mac?"
"Yes."
He edged closer, the older man coming into sharper focus, the sour sweetness of red wine on his breath.
"Do you know me?"
he asked.
"Pardon?"
Now the fear was fermenting into rage.
"Do you know me? Did you do this to me?"
The old man said,
"I've never seen you before in my life. Is that right?"
His hands were balling involuntarily into fists.
"Is there another Mac in this town?"
"Not that I'm aware of."
Mac pushed open the screen door, ventured a step out onto the porch.
"Buddy, you don't look so hot."
"I don't feel so hot."
"What happened to you?"
"You tell me, Mac."
A woman's voice called out from somewhere in the house.
"Honey, everything okay?"
"Yes, Jane, all's well."
Mac stared at him.
"Why don't you let me take you to the hospital? You're injured. You need—"
"I'm not going anywhere with you."
"Then why are you at my house?"
A gruff edge had entered Mac's voice.
"I just offered to help you." "You don't want that? Fine, but—"
Mac was still talking, but his words had begun to dissolve. drowned out by a noise building in the pit of his stomach like the roar of a freight train barreling toward him. The black holes were multiplying, the world beginning to spin. He simply wasn't going to be able to stay on his feet another 5 seconds if his head didn't explode first. He looked up at Mac, the man's mouth still moving, that freight train closing in with a vengeance of noise, its rhythm in lockstep with the brutal pounding in his head, and he couldn't take his eyes off Mac's mouth, the old man's teeth, his synapses sparking, trying to connect, and the noise, God, the noise and the throbbing. He didn't feel his knees give out, didn't even register the backward stumble. 1 second he was on the porch, the next the grass, flat on his back and his head reeling from a hard slam against the ground. Mac hovering above him now, staring down at him, bent over with his hands on his knees and his words hopelessly lost to the train that was screaming through his head. He was going to lose consciousness. He could feel it coming seconds away, and he wanted it, wanted the pain to stop, but the answers, they were right there, so close. It made no sense, but there was something about Mac's mouth, his teeth. He couldn't stop looking at them, and he didn't know why, but it was all there, an explanation. Answers to everything, and it occurred to him, stop fighting it. Stop wanting it so badly. Quit thinking. Just let it come. The teeth, the teeth, the teeth, the teeth, the teeth, the teeth, the teeth. They aren't teeth. They're a bright and shiny grill with the letters M-A-C-K stamped across the front. Stallings, the man beside him in the front passenger seat, doesn't see what's coming. In the 3-hour ride north out of Boise, it becomes apparent that Stallings adores the sound of his own voice, and he's doing what he's been doing the entire time, talking. He stopped listening an hour ago when he discovered he could tune out completely as long as he interjected and I hadn't thought of it that way, or, interesting, every 5 minutes or so. He's turned to make just such a token contribution to the conversation when he reads the word Mac several feet away on the other side of Stallings' window. Hasn't even begun to react. He's barely read the word when the window beside Stallings' head bursts into a shower of glass pebbles. The airbag explodes out of the steering column, but it's a millisecond late, just missing his head, which slams into the window with enough force to punch through. The right side of the Lincoln Town car implodes in an apocalypse of breaking glass and bending metal, and Stallings' head takes a direct hit from the truck's grill. Ethan can feel the heat from the truck's engine as it tears into the car, the sudden reek of gasoline and brake fluid. Blood is everywhere, running down the inside of the fractured windshield, spattered across the dash in his eyes, still erupting out of what's left of Stallings. The town car is sliding crosswise through an intersection, being pushed by the truck toward the side of that brownstone with the phone booth near the alley, when he loses consciousness. Chapter 2. A woman was smiling down at him. At least, he thought those were a mouthful of pretty teeth, although his blurred double vision made it difficult to say for sure. She leaned in a little closer, her two heads merging and her features crystallizing enough for him to see she was beautiful. Her short-sleeved uniform was white with buttons all the way down the front to where the skirt stopped just above her knees. She kept repeating his name. Mr. Burke? Mr. Burke, can you hear me? Mr. Burke? The headache was gone. He took a slow, careful breath until the pain in his ribs cut him off. He must have winced, because the nurse said, "Are you still experiencing discomfort in your left side?"
"Discomfort?" he groaned through a laugh. "Yes, I'm experiencing discomfort. You could certainly call it that."
"I can get something a little stronger for the pain if you'd like."
"I think I can manage."
"All right. But don't you be a martyr, Mr. Burke. Anything I can do to make you more comfortable, just name it. I'm your girl, My name's Pam, by the way.
Thank you, Pam. I think I remember you from the last time I was here. I'd never forget that classic nurse's uniform. I didn't even know they still made those.
She laughed. Well, I'm glad to hear your memories coming back. That's very good. Dr. Mitre will be in shortly to see you. Would you mind if I took a blood pressure reading?
Sure.
Wonderful.
Nurse Pam lifted a blood pressure pump from a cart at the foot of the bed and strapped the cuff around his left biceps.
You gave us a scare, Mr. Burke, she said as she inflated the cuff, walking off like that.
She was quiet while the needle fell.
Did I pass? He asked.
A plus. Systolic is 122, diastolic 75.
She unvelcroed the cuff.
When they brought you in, you were delirious, she said. You didn't seem to know who you were.
He sat up in bed, the fog in his head beginning to lift. He was in a private hospital room. He thought it looked familiar. There was a window beside the bed. The blinds had been drawn, but the light creeping through seemed timid enough to be either early morning or early evening.
Where'd you find me? He asked.
Max Cozy's front yard. You'd blacked out. Do you remember what you were doing there? Max said you seemed pretty agitated and confused.
I woke up yesterday by the river. I didn't know who I was or where I was.
You'd left the hospital. Do you remember leaving?
No. I went to the Scozy residence because he was the only Mac in the phone book.
I don't think I understand.
Mac was the only name that held any meaning for me.
Why do you think that is?
Because Mac is the last word I read before the truck hit us.
Oh, right. It was a Mac truck that T-boned your car.
Exactly.
The mind is a weird thing, the nurse said, moving around the end of the bed and walking over to the window. It works in mysterious ways. Seeks out the strangest connections.
How long has it been since I was brought back here?
She raised the blinds.
Day and a half.
Light streamed in. It was actually late morning, the sun just clearing the eastern rim of cliffs.
You had a bad concussion, she said. You could have died out there.
I felt like I was dying.
The early light pouring down into the town was stunning.
How's your memory? Pam asked.
Weirdest thing. It all came back when I remembered the accident. Like someone just flipped a switch. How's Agent Stallings?
Who?
The man who was riding in the front passenger seat of the car when the collision happened.
Oh.
He didn't make it, did he?
Nurse Pam walked back over to the bedside. She reached down, put her hand on his wrist.
I'm afraid not.
He'd assumed as much. Hadn't seen that sort of trauma since the war. Still, to have that suspicion confirmed was a sobering thing.
Was he a close friend of yours?
The nurse asked.
No. I'd met him for the first time earlier that day.
Must have been just awful. I'm so sorry.
What's my damage?
Excuse me?
My injuries?
Dr. Mitre will be able to fill you in better than I can, but you suffered a concussion, which is resolved now. A few cracked ribs, some superficial cuts and bruises. All things considered, it could have been much, much worse for you.
She turned away and headed for the door, stopping as she started to pull it open for a quick glance back over her shoulder.
So, she said, we're sure about your memory coming back?
Absolutely.
What's your first name?
Ethan, he said.
Excellent.
Could you do me a favor? Ethan asked.
Big, high wattage smile.
Name it.
There are people I need to call. My wife. My sack. Has anyone been in contact with them?
I believe someone from the sheriff's office got in touch with your emergency contacts right after the accident. Let them know what happened, your condition.
I had an iPhone in my jacket at the time of the collision.
Would you happen to know where it is?
No, but I can certainly put on my Nancy Drew detective hat and check into that for you.
I'd appreciate it. That little red button on the side of the railing, see it? Ethan glanced down at it. I'm one click away.
Nurse Pam flashed one more brilliant smile and left. There was no television in the room and no telephone. The best and only entertainment was the wall clock hanging above the door, and he lay in bed for several hours watching the second hand make its endless orbit as the morning turned to midday and then to afternoon. He couldn't be sure, but his room appeared to be 3, possibly 4 floors up. Nurse Pam had left the blinds open, and when he tired of clock watching, he turned carefully over onto his good side and studied the happenings of Wayward Pines. From his vantage point, he could see straight down Main Street and several blocks back on either side. He'd known prior to coming here that it was a tiny, sleepy town, but the sheer inactivity still surprised him. An hour elapsed, and he counted a dozen people strolling down the sidewalk past the hospital, and not a single car driving down the town's busiest thoroughfare. The most effective object of distraction was 2 blocks away, a construction crew framing a house. He thought about his wife and son back in Seattle, hoping they were already en route to see him. They'd probably caught the first plane out. They would have had to fly into Boise or Missoula, rent a car for the long trek out to Wayward Pines. The next time he glanced at the clock, it was 3:45. He'd been lying in this bed all day, and Dr. Mitre, or whatever his name was, hadn't even bothered to stop by. Ethan had spent significant time in hospitals, and in his experience, nurses and doctors never left you alone for more than 10 seconds, someone always bringing some new medication, always prodding and poking. Here, they'd practically ignored him. Nurse Pam had never even shown up with his iPhone and other belongings. How busy could this hospital in the middle of nowhere be? He reached for the control panel attached to the railing and jammed his thumb into the nurse call button. 15 minutes later, the door to his room swung open and Nurse Pam breezed through.
Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't see that you rang until 10 seconds ago. I think we're having some issues with our intercom. She stopped at the foot of the bed and put her hands on the metal railing. How can I help you, Ethan?
Where's Dr. Mitre?
She grimaced.
He's been tied up in an emergency surgery all afternoon.
One of those 5-hour nightmares, she laughed. But I filled him in on your vitals this morning and the fantastic progress you're making with your memory, and he thinks you're doing A-okay. She gave Ethan a double thumbs up.
When can I see him?
It's looking like he'll make his rounds after supper now, which should be coming up in the next 30 minutes.
Ethan struggled to mask his growing frustration. Any luck finding my phone and other things I had with me before the accident? This would include my wallet and a black briefcase. Nurse Pam gave a half salute and marched in place for several steps.
Working on it, Captain.
Just bring me a landline right now. I need to make some calls.
Of course, Marshal.
Marshal?
Aren't you like a U.S. Marshal or something?
No. I'm a special agent with the United States Secret Service.
Really?
Really.
I thought you guys protected the President.
We handle some other things, too.
So what are you doing out here in our little slice of heaven?
Ethan gave her a cool, thin smile. I can't discuss that. He could, actually. Just didn't feel like it.
Well, now you've got me all intrigued.
The phone, Pam?
Excuse me?
I really need the phone.
I'm on it.
It was when supper finally came, servings of green and brown goo compartmentalized on a shiny metal tray, and the phone didn't, that Ethan decided to leave. Sure, he'd slipped out once before, but he'd been out of his mind at the time, suffering from a severe concussion. Now he was thinking clearly. The headache was gone, he could breathe easier and with less pain, and if the doctor had any real concern regarding his condition, maybe the asshole would have given him the courtesy of stopping by at some point during the last 10 hours. Ethan waited until Nurse Pam had left, her parting shot assuring him that the hospital food tastes so much better than it looks. When the door closed, he tugged the IV needle out of his wrist and climbed over the railing. The linoleum floor was cold against the soles of his bare feet. He felt a few pegs down from completely stable, but still light years ahead of his condition 48 hours ago. Ethan padded over to the closet, pulled open the door. His shirt, jacket, and pants were on a hanger, his shoes on the floor underneath. No socks, no briefs. Guess I'll roll commando. The only pain came when he bent over to pull on his pants, a sharp twinge high on his left side that went away when he straightened back up. He caught a glimpse of his bare legs, and as always, the nexus of scarring jogged him out of the moment, fighting to pull him 8 years back to a brown-walled room whose stench of death would never leave him. He checked and found the pocket knife still inside his jacket. Good. It was a relic from his early 20s when he'd worked as a helicopter mechanic, more of a talisman now than a functional tool, but it offered some degree of comfort to know it was there. He stood in front of a mirror in the bathroom, fumbling with his tie. It took him 5 attempts to get it right, fingers misfiring and clumsy, like he hadn't tied one in years. When he'd finally cinched down a mediocre Windsor knot, he took a step back to appraise himself. The bruises on his face looked marginally better, but his jacket still bore grass and dirt stains and a small tear across the left pocket. The white Oxford shirt underneath was also stained. He could see the smattering of blood near the collar. He'd lost several inches from his waist over the last few days and had to fasten his belt on the last notch. Still, his pants felt too loose. He turned on the tap, wet his hands, and ran his fingers through his hair. Fixed his part, tried to assign it some semblance of order. He swished with lukewarm water several times, but his teeth still felt mossy. Sniffed his armpits. Stink. He also needed a shave. It had been years since he'd looked this rough. He stepped into his shoes, laced them up, and headed out of the bathroom toward the door. His first instinct was to leave without being seen, and this puzzled him. He was a federal agent with the full authority of the United States government. This meant people had to do what he said, even nurses and doctors. They didn't want him to leave. Tough shit. And yet, some part of him was resisting the hassle of an incident. It was stupid, he knew, but he didn't want Nurse Pam catching him. He turned the doorknob, opened the door an inch from the jamb. What he could see of the corridor beyond was empty. He strained to listen. No distant chatter of nurses. No footsteps. Just blaring silence. He poked his head out. A quick glance left and right confirmed his suspicion. For the moment, the place was empty, even the nurse's station 50 feet down the corridor. He stepped out of his room onto the checkered linoleum floor and closed the door softly behind him. Out here, the only sound came from the fluorescent lights overhead, a soft, steady hum. He suddenly realized what he should have done in the first place and bent down through the pain in his ribs to unlace his shoes. In bare feet, he moved down the corridor. Every door on this wing was shut, and with no light slipping through the cracks beneath the door, none of the rooms but his appeared to be occupied. The nurse's station stood vacant at the intersection of 4 corridors, 3 of which led to additional wings of patient rooms. A shorter hallway behind the station ran down to a pair of double doors with the word "surgical" emblazoned on a nameplate above them. Ethan stopped at the elevator right across from the station and punched the down arrow. He heard pulleys beginning to turn through the doors. Come on. It took years. Realized he should have just taken the stairs. He kept looking over his shoulder, listening for approaching footsteps, but he couldn't hear a thing over the noise of the rising elevator. The doors finally separated with a screech that made his teeth ache, and he stepped to the side in the event someone had ridden up. No one exited the car. He hurried inside and pressed G. Studying the illuminated numbers over the doors, he watched as the car began its slow descent from 4, and a full minute had passed, enough time for him to put his shoes back on, before the G illuminated and the doors began to creak open. He squeezed through, stepped out into another intersection of hallways. Voices murmured not far away. The noise of a stretcher rolling on a squeaky wheel. He went the opposite way, tracking through 3 long corridors, and had begun to suspect he was lost when he spotted an exit sign. He hurried down a half flight of stairs, punched through the door at the bottom, and stumbled outside. It was early evening, the sky clear and fading, and the mountains taking on the afterlight of the sun in tones of pink and orange. He stood on a short walkway extending out from the hospital, a 4-story red brick building that reminded him more of a school or a mental asylum. He took as deep a shot of oxygen as he could without bringing the pain, and it felt amazing to inhale this cool, pine-scented air after breathing the hospital's antiseptic stench. He reached the sidewalk and started down Main Street toward the buildings of downtown. There were more people out than in the afternoon. He passed a restaurant situated in a small house with a patio off to the side. People dined outside under aspen trees strung with tiny white lights. The smell of food made his stomach growl. At the corner of Main and Fifth, he crossed the street and returned to the phone booth where he'd lost consciousness 2 days before. Stepping inside, he thumbed through the directory until he found the street address of the Wayward Pines Sheriff's Office. He felt better than he had in days walking toward the east side of town as the light began to fail and the temperature dropped. He strolled past a barbecue in progress, the smell of charcoal on the breeze, the good, sour aroma of beer wafting out of plastic cups, the sound of children's laughter echoing through the valley, the cicada-like clicking of a water sprinkler nearby. Everywhere he looked, it was a painting. Like the platonic ideal of a town. There couldn't have been more than 400 or 500 people living here, and he found himself wondering what had brought them. How many had discovered Wayward Pines by accident, fell in love, stayed? How many had been born here and never left? Much as he'd always been a big city guy, he could understand not leaving a place like this. Why abandon what appeared to be complete and total perfection? Quintessential Americana surrounded by some of the most striking natural beauty he'd ever laid eyes on. He'd seen pictures of Wayward Pines the night before he left Seattle, but none of them had even come close to doing this little valley justice. And still, he was here. And by virtue of that fact, or rather because of it, this place wasn't perfect. His experience, there was darkness everywhere human beings gathered. The way of the world. Perfection was a surface thing. The epidermis. Cut a few layers deep, you begin to see some darker shades. Cut to the bone, pitch black. He couldn't take his eyes off the mountains as he walked. The eastern wall must have gone up 3,000 or 4,000 feet. Toward the top, all rock and ice. The final strands of horizontal sunlight were striking the cliffs at his back, and he turned around and took a moment to stop and watch the glow fade away. When the light was gone, the rock turned instantly to the color of blued steel, and the nature of it changed. It was still beautiful, but more remote, indifferent. The placard above the glass double doors. Office of the Sheriff of Wayward Pines. Moving toward the front entrance down a walkway lined with baby pines, he felt a new impulse of frustration course through him. Through the glass, he could see that the lobby was dark and empty. Still, he grabbed the doors and gave them a rough tug. Locked. It was after hours, sure, but God damn it. Ethan backed away from the entrance, glanced down the length of the single-story building. On the far end, it looked like a bit of light was slipping through the blinds behind a window. He moved forward again, rapped his knuckles against one of the glass doors. Nothing. He banged with even more force, pounding the glass so hard the doors rattled in their frames. 5 minutes passed, but no one ever came. Two stars and a planet had appeared by the time he reached Main Street, and the chill that had been pleasant 15 minutes ago had become uncomfortable, cutting through his thin Oxford shirt, his sockless feet beginning to tingle with numbness. Worse, the first sign of real hunger was manifesting itself as a hollow ache in the pit of his stomach and a dizziness behind his eyes. He walked several blocks down to the Wayward Pines Hotel and climbed the stone steps to the entrance. Through the panes of glass in the door, he saw lights on inside and a young woman sitting behind the front desk. Ethan entered the lobby into a welcome blast of warmth. A grand piano occupied a corner across from the massive hearth, which presently housed a roaring fire. He stopped for a moment and held his hands out to the heat. The boiling pine resin gave off the sweet smell of a candle. He could have stretched out on the couch and napped for days. After a moment, he dragged himself away and walked over to the front desk. The woman smiled at Ethan as he approached. She struck him as mid-twenties. Cute, though a little on the heavy side, her black hair pulled into a short ponytail. She wore a white dress shirt under a black vest, and her name tag identified her as Lisa. Ethan sidled up to the desk and rested his forearms on the high counter to steady his balance.
"Good evening," Lisa said. "Welcome to the Wayward Pines Hotel. How may I help you tonight?"
Her greeting seemed off, not the words but the delivery, like she was struggling through something she rarely had to say. "Do you have any vacancies tonight?"
"We sure do,"
Lisa typed on a keyboard.
"Just tonight?"
she asked.
"Yes, for now at least."
Ethan glanced at the computer monitor, an ancient monstrosity, like something from the late 80s. He couldn't remember the last time he'd seen such a dinosaur.
"I have a non-smoking, non-pet room on the second floor with a king bed."
"That'll be fine," she finished typing.
"And would you like to put this on a credit card?"
Ethan smiled. "That's an interesting question."
"Really? How so?"
"I was involved in a car accident several days ago. A truck slammed into the side of my car, just up the block from here, actually. Maybe you saw it?"
"No, I sure didn't."
"Well, I was just released from the hospital, and the thing is, I haven't been able to locate my wallet. None of my personal belongings, in fact."
"Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that."
He thought he saw Lisa's smile lose just a touch of its initial enthusiasm.
"So how exactly will you be paying then, Mr.
Burke, Ethan Burke? See, that's what I'm trying to tell you. I won't be able to pay for the room until I get my wallet back tomorrow. I'm informed the sheriff is in possession of my things. Not sure why, but..." he shrugged. "Is what it is."
"See, I'm not really allowed to open a reservation without a cash advance or at least a credit card number. It's hotel policy. In case, and of course I'm not saying that this would necessarily happen, but in case there was any damage to the room or charges incurred that..."
"I understand that. I'm well aware of the purpose of deposits. What I'm telling you is that I will be able to pay you tomorrow morning."
"You don't even have a driver's license?"
"Everything's in my wallet." Lisa bit her bottom lip, and he could see what was coming, a nice girl working herself up to be the bad guy.
"Sir, Mr. Burke, I'm afraid that without a credit card or cash or identification, I'm just not going to be able to give you a room tonight. I would love to, really. But this is just hotel policy, and..."
She stopped talking when Ethan leaned over the counter. "Lisa, do you know why I'm wearing a black suit?"
"No,"
I'm a special agent with the United States Secret Service.
You mean those guys who guard the president?
That's only one of our duties. Our primary mission is to protect the integrity of our nation's financial infrastructure.
And so you're like, on an investigation in Wayward Pines?
I am. I had just arrived in town when the accident happened.
What kind of investigation?
I can't discuss any details.
You're not pulling my leg, are you?
If I was, I'd be committing a federal crime.
You're really a special agent?
Yes. And I'm tired, and I'm asking you to give me a break. I need a room for the night. I promise you, I'm good for it.
And you'll pay tomorrow? First thing?
First thing. Key in hand, he trudged up the steps to the second floor and emerged into a long, quiet corridor. Faux lanterns had been mounted to the walls every 20 feet, and they shed a weak, yellow light on the Persian carpeting. His room was at the far end, number 226. He unlocked the door, stepped inside, hit the light. The decor ran to the folksy side of the spectrum. Two badly done iconic Western scenes. A cowboy on a bucking bronco. Group of ranch hands huddled around a campfire. The room was stuffy, and there was no television. Just an old-school black rotary phone sitting on one of the bedside tables. The bed itself looked soft and enormous. Ethan eased down onto the mattress and unlaced his shoes. Walking around without socks had already started several blisters on the backs of his feet. He took off his jacket, his tie, and undid the first three buttons of his Oxford shirt. There was a phone directory in the bedside table drawer, and he took it out, set it on the bed, and lifted the antique phone. Dial tone. Thank God. Strangely, his home phone number didn't immediately spring to mind. He had to spend a minute visualizing it, trying to picture how the number appeared when he smart-dialed on his iPhone. He'd had it just the other day, but 206. He knew it started with those three numbers, the Seattle area code, and five times he spun them out on the rotary phone, but five times he blanked after the six. He dialed 411. After two rings, an operator answered with, "What city enlisting?" "Seattle, Washington. Ethan Burke, B-U-R-K-E. "One moment, please." Over the line, he could hear the woman typing. There was a long pause. Then, "B-U-R-K-E?" "That's right."
"Sir, I'm not showing a listing under that name."
"You're sure?"
"Yes."
It was certainly odd, but considering the nature of his job, his number was probably unlisted. Come to think of it, he was almost sure it was. Almost. "Okay, thank you." He shelved the phone and opened the phone book, located the number to the sheriff's office. It rang five times and then went to voicemail. After the beep, Ethan said, "This is Special Agent Ethan Burke with the United States Secret Service, Seattle Field Office. As you know, I was involved in the vehicular accident on Main Street several days ago. I need to speak with you at your earliest convenience. The hospital informed me that you are in possession of my personal belongings, including my wallet, phone, briefcase, and firearm. I'll be coming by first thing in the morning to pick them up. If anyone gets this message before then, please call me at the Wayward Pines Hotel. I'm staying in room 226. It was full-on night as Ethan walked down the steps from the hotel entrance, his feet killing him, hungry as hell. The cafe adjacent to the hotel was closed, so he headed north under a sky filled with stars, past a rare bookstore, a couple of gift shops, and a law office. It wasn't that late, but with everything closed for the night, the sidewalks of Maine had emptied out. He'd begun to come to terms with the horror of not having dinner on top of everything else when he spotted light spilling onto the pavement on the next block down. His pace involuntarily quickened as he caught the first whiff of hot food exhausting out of a vent in the building up ahead. When he reached the entrance, he stared through the storefront glass into a dimly lighted pub called the Biergarten. His heart swelled, still open. He walked inside. Three tables occupied, but otherwise the place was dead. He took a corner stool at the bar. Through a pair of swinging doors drifted the sizzle of meat cooking on an open grill. Sitting in this pub, his arms resting on the well-worn bar, he felt at peace for the first time in days. The memory of Stallings and the accident was near, threatening to muscle its way in, but he refused to let it dominate his mind. Simply breathed in and out, and tried to stay as firmly planted as possible in the moment. After 5 minutes, a tall woman with a pile of brown hair propped up with chopsticks pushed through the swinging doors and opened a hinged section of the bar. She came around to Ethan, all smiles, and tossed a drink coaster down in front of him. "What you drinking?" She wore a black T-shirt with the pub's name screen-printed across the front. "A beer would be great." The barkeep grabbed a pint glass and moved over to the taps. "Something light? Dark?" "You have Guinness?" "I got something like that." She'd already pulled the tap when he remembered he didn't have any money. She set the glass in front of him, cream foam spilling down the sides, said, "You just drinking, or you want to see a menu?" "Food for sure," he said, "but you're going to kill me." The woman smiled. "Not yet. I hardly know you." "I don't have any money." Her smile died. "Okay, maybe you're onto something." "I can explain. You see the car wreck that happened on Main a few days ago?"
"No."
"You hear about it?"
"No."
"Well, there was one, just a few blocks south of here, and I was involved in it. Just got out of the hospital, in fact."
"So that's where you got those pretty bruises?"
"Right."
"I'm still trying to figure out what this has to do with you not paying me."
"I'm a federal agent."
"Same question?"
"Apparently, the sheriff has my wallet and phone. Everything, actually. It's been a huge headache."
"So what are you, like, FBI or something?"
"Secret Service." The woman smiled, leaned toward him across the bar. It had been hard to tell in the low light, but in proximity she was damn good-looking. A few years younger than Ethan, with model cheekbones, short torsoed and long-legged. Had probably been a stone-cold knockout in her 20s, although 34 or 35, whatever she was now, didn't seem to be treating her too badly.
"I don't know if you're a confidence man, and this is just a part of your game coming in here with your black suit and this crazy..."
"I'm not lying." She touched a finger to his lips.
"The way I figure, you're either exactly who you say you are, or you're a spectacular liar. I mean, this is a good story, and I love good stories. Either way, of course I'll let you have dinner on credit."
"It's not a lie." "What's your name?"
"Beverly."
"I'm Ethan." She shook his hand. "Pleased to meet you, Ethan. Beverly, as soon as I get my wallet and things tomorrow morning, I'm gonna come in here, let me guess, and lay a big tip on me." Ethan shook his head. "Now you're mocking me."
"I'm sorry."
"If you don't believe me, I'll..."
"I just met you," she said. "By the time you're finished with dinner, I'll know whether or not I'll ever see you again."
"Too early to say, huh?" He smiled, feeling like he might be winning her over. She brought him a menu